Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture presented by Boston University's Institute for Philosophy and Religion titled Religion Without God, An Indian Perspective. Our speaker is Parimal Patel, professor of religion and Indian philosophy and chair of the Department of South Asian Studies at Harvard University. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Institute for Philosophy and Religion Chair David Eckel.
Let me tell you just a word or two about Parimal Patel, and then I will turn things over to him for the evening's lecture. Parimal is a great friend of mine and a great friend of Boston University. He's the professor of philosophy and religion in the Department of South Asian Studies at Harvard and the chair of the department. He's particularly interested in Indian Buddhism, its intellectual history in South Asia, in Buddhist, Hindu, and Jain debates on aesthetics, epistemology, metaphysics, and the philosophy of language. That's an impressive series of topics, and it's not always easy to be a specialist in all of those at once, and Professor Patel manages to keep all of those great topics in the air simultaneously. He has worked on debate in the Buddhist tradition, especially in its final, most sophisticated phase. And more recently, he's been interested in classical South Asian literature and literary theory, in other words, Indian poetry and drama, and its relevance to historiography and religious ethics. He is, in my view, one of the most remarkable members of a new generation of talented young scholars of Indian philosophy and religion who can fluently and authoritatively cross the line between East and West and between philosophy and the study of religion. He is a great friend of the Institute. We're thrilled that he's here to speak to us tonight on a topic that I believe will be of great interest to you. So please welcome Professor Patel. Give him a warm welcome. And we're thrilled you're here.
At this age, I know someone's a good friend when I'm described as young in almost any context, so I'm grateful. So hermeneutics, the study of methods for interpretation and the recovery of meaning, is among the most neglected subject areas in the study of Indian philosophy. This is surprising given the commentarial nature of Sanskrit philosophers and philosophical literature. Unlike many contemporary philosophers, Sanskrit philosophers often identify themselves with specific text traditions and develop their own philosophical positions by commenting on texts that their traditions take to be foundational. Hermeneutics is, therefore, inherent in, and also essential to, the practice of philosophy in classical India. Among Sanskrit philosophers, the standards for philosophical hermeneutics were set by those who followed the text traditions defined by Jaimini's Mimamsa Sutras. Later philosophers and theologians, such as those who followed the text traditions defined by Badarayana's Vedanta Sutras, developed their hermeneutics in close and critical conversation with the practices of the Mimamsakas. An essential feature of both of these traditions is their commitment to Veda, the paradigmatic category of Hindu scripture, and the definitive source for knowledge of Dharma. The commitment of Mimamsa and Vedanta to Veda is such that to a significant degree, the philosophical projects of many Vedantins and Mimamsakas can be understood as attempts at recovering and systematizing the meaning of Vedic texts and practices. For many Mimamsakas and Vedantins, therefore, it is with Vedic exegesis and hermeneutics that philosophical theology must begin. Today, I want to focus on how Vedic texts were used by a remarkable philosophical theologian from pre-modern India, the Mimamsaka Kumarla Bhatta. More specifically, I want to discuss Kumarla's approach to Vedic hermeneutics in order to discover what we can learn from him about scripture, its authoritative status, and what it means to properly understand it. So is it clear? So there's a man named Kumarla Bhatta. I'm calling him a philosophical theologian, even though he has no interest or no commitment to theos of any kind. His commitment instead is to dharma, and so he's a philosophical dharma logian. And what he does is he develops his worldview by providing an exegesis of this authoritative text called Veda. And what we want to look at is, why is Veda authoritative for him, and how does he then work out a philosophical theology on the basis of it? I'll organize my remarks around the following three questions, and we'll try and explain how Kumarala would answer each of them. The question that I want to ask are, one, what counts as scripture, especially when there's neither script nor scriptor? Two, wherein lies its authority? And three, what can be said about philosophical theology on the basis of scripture? And how can this be justified through exegesis and other commentarial and quasi-commentarial practices? I hope that by seeking answers to these questions, we will be able to better understand the role that Veda played in intellectual and philosophical contexts, discover something about the relationship between hermeneutics and philosophical theology in classical India, and perhaps learn something about how we might want to think about these issues today. According to Mimamsaka such as Kumarala, Veda is the paradigmatic category of Hindu scripture. This is because the texts that belong to this category are taken to be the uniquely authoritative foundation for our knowledge of dharma, that is, our knowledge of what we should and should not do if we want to get things that we believe will contribute to our satisfaction in this life and beyond. It is in how to acquire a wide variety of good things, such as cows, rain, sons, yogic powers, revenge, and heaven, through processes such as ritual, whose workings we cannot explain empirically, that is the domain of dharma. In these matters, Veda is taken to be uniquely authoritative, since it is the only infallible source for our knowledge of this trans-empirical domain and the trans-empirical processes that are essential to it. Like the universe itself, Veda is said to be eternal, and as a result, it is said to be authorless, and therefore free from the kinds of errors and judgments that plague both human and divine compositions. It is uniquely foundational in that without Veda, there would be no way of knowing dharma. The domain of dharma is said to be inaccessible to all ordinary and extraordinary ways of knowing. Veda is therefore understood to be the unique, uncreated, timeless, and infallible testimony of dharma itself. Now, while the basis for our knowledge of dharma is said to be Veda, our awareness of this fact is based on reasoning. Thus, important parts of Kumarala's work are devoted to demonstrating rationally that our knowledge of dharma must be based on Veda. It may be helpful to think of this as Kumarala's philosophical project in order to distinguish it from his more theological project of providing a framework within which to understand Veda and therefore dharma. Is that okay? So Kumarala actually thinks that the Veda is the only way we can come to know trans-empirical or non-empirical matters. So for example, if you want to get rain, you have to perform a certain ritual, he thinks, and by performing that ritual, you will get rain. To know that this ritual will lead to rain and how it works is not something he thinks we can discover by any empirical means. The only way we can understand it is through dharma. And part of his project is to demonstrate that. We're not going to talk about how he demonstrates it, but that's part of it. Another thing he wants to demonstrate is Veda is not composed by anyone, neither God nor human being. It is authorless. And the reason he says this is, he thinks that that's the only way to guarantee that it's going to be authoritative. He thinks if there is an agent involved of any sort, there's the possibility of Veda being fallible. So it's infallible, perhaps counterintuitively to us, precisely because it has no author. Right? So what is Veda, first? So according to Mimamsaka, such as Kumarala, Veda is restricted to the texts of the Rig, Yajus, and Sama Veda. For them, the status of the Atharvaveda corpus is more problematic, and it may not be Vedic at all. Even within the texts that define the category of Veda, there's a difference in the authoritative status of different kinds of liturgical linguistic expressions found in them. For example, injunctions on the one hand, and liturgical utterances called mantras, recommending narratives called arthavadas, and names on the other. The idea is that Veda is made up of different kinds of sentences, different kinds of statements, just like most books are. Those that issue commands have a different status than those that mention names and that those that kind of motivate you to perform certain commands. That's the first point. So injunctions such as the statement, someone who seeks heaven should perform the Agnishtoma ritual, stipulate what one who seeks certain things should do and what one who seeks to avoid certain things should not do. They define dharma and so are, by definition, authoritative. According to Kumarila, the Vedic injunction to study the Veda implies that each and every statement in the Veda must be attributed to, since each serves a purpose that is relevant for our knowledge of dharma. The ways in which these statements are relevant can almost always be traced to how they are related to specific injunctions. For example, liturgical utterances, such as the statement, "I offer the leftovers to Agni," it might sound strange, right? We have a ritual. If you want something, you have to perform this ritual. That's an injunction, right? It's a command. That command is a central piece of how he organizes Veda. There are other things that aren't commands. For example, the statement, "I offer the leftovers to Agni." So you might wonder, what does this statement, "I offer the leftovers to Agni," which seems to mention a god, Agni, have to do with the command to perform a particular ritual, right? This is kind of the idea. If you take apart scripture into different component parts, how do all the parts relate together? Are they all equally authoritative or not? So Kumarila doesn't think they're all equally authoritative. So here's what he says about why "I offer the leftovers to Agni" contributes to dharma. He says that they contribute to dharma because when uttered during the performance of a ritual, they typically bring to mind specific things that are necessary for the enjoined ritual action to be successful, such as the name of the deity to whom one is making the offering. In effect, liturgical utterances trigger one's memory about things that are relevant for the performance of a particular enjoined act. Since such statements are a part of Veda, they are authoritative. But insofar as their only function is to trigger one's memory, like a mnemonic, their authority extends only to the linguistic form of the utterance itself. Recommending narratives are also authoritative in that they are a part of Veda. The nature of their authority, however, is rather different from that of liturgical utterances. Recommending narratives, such as the statement, "Vayu is the fastest of divine beings," are correlated with specific injunctions and support the injunctions with which they are correlated. By implying, for example, that an offering to the fastest of divine beings will lead to fastest results, the statement, "Vayu is the fastest of divine beings," supports an injunction by motivating a person to perform a ritual to Vayu. It is important to note that according to Kumarila, recommending narratives neither tell us what we should want, right? They do not prompt us to desire certain things, nor do they tell us anything about what the world is like. They do not have any factual or informational content. Rather, they are merely instrumental. That is, they make use of convenient fictions to motivate us to undertake certain enjoined acts. They're authoritative only with respect to the positive and negative advice they provide about the best way to bring about a particular result. So if you want, for example, rain, there may be a part of the Veda that motivates you, that's kind of a cheerleader for you to do the rain ritual, right? Like the example I gave, Vayu is the fastest of divine beings. That's supposed to be a kind of motivating factor for you to perform a ritual to Vayu, because the implication is, since Vayu is so fast, you'll get the results very quickly. It doesn't imply anything about whether there is any kind of deity called Vayu or not, according to Kumarila. The privileged status of Veda itself does not mean, however, that there are no other sources that can be used for learning about dharma. In fact, there are numerous other textual sources that are said to be authoritative, though not foundational. These texts are not strictly speaking Veda. Rather, they are Vedic, or based on or derived from Veda. In addition, there are also non-textual sources, such as the behavior of good learned people. To better understand the scope of the category of scripture and the ways in which Vedic texts and practices are also authoritative, it'll be helpful to consider why Kumarila takes the Sanskrit epics and the Dharma text of Manu, as well as the behavior of good learned people, to be authoritative with respect to dharma. Remember, I said that one of the things about Veda is it provides you with access to things you can't know in any other way. And that's one of the things that makes it scriptural, right? Gives it authority, because it's uniquely authoritative. But there are also other sources of authority, even though they're not foundationally authoritative. So, for example, something Vedic. There are texts like the Indian epics, I don't know if you know of them, the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, or so-called Hindu law books called the Dharma Shastra, which also have authority. The question is, how? So according to Kumarila, the Sanskrit epics The Mahabharata and the Ramayana were composed by Vyasa and Valmiki, people, in strict accordance with Veda. They are, therefore, completely consistent with it, according to him. Each contains injunctions and an incredible number of purely narrative episodes. Both epics are also said by Kumarla to be universally studied and accepted by the learned, and to be relevant for nearly everyone. Kumarla explains that many of the injunctions found in the epics are directly based on those found in Veda, and so are absolutely authoritative with respect to Dharma. The epics are so consistent with Veda that Kumarla says that we can even reason that the epic injunctions that are not found in Veda itself are still authoritative, since they must be based on Vedic statements that were known to the learned author of the epics, but are no longer extant, and so no longer known to us. So we have Veda, which has injunctions, right? We also have these other texts which were written by people. But because those texts are deemed to be consistent with Veda, when those texts have an injunction or a command to do something, it's taken to be equally authoritative, even though it isn't part of Veda itself. Why? Because everything in it is consistent with Veda. So something that isn't, that's in it but not in Veda itself, must be consistent with Veda also, and therefore must be authoritative, even though it isn't sourced in Veda itself. So that means the category of scripture is not just restricted to Veda, but to things that are Vedic. And the epics are one example. This Dharma text of Manu is another example. For Kumarla, of the numerous Dharma texts, only the Dharma text of Manu is authoritative. He says that unlike the other well-known texts of Dharma, it alone is applicable throughout the world and universally accepted by the learned. Kumarla also notes that many of the injunctions found in it are also found in Veda, and that, in fact, there's only one injunction that is not entirely consistent with Veda. On the basis of these observable facts, Kumarla concludes that Manu constructed his text to be in strict accordance with Veda, and therefore that any injunction in Manu's text that is not found in Veda must be based on a Vedic text that is no longer available to us, either because the text itself is no longer extant or because it's extant but lost. Kumarla argues that the assumption of a Vedic source for these injunctions is the simplest and only way to account for the recognized excellence of Manu's texts and the confidence that generations of learned people have had in it. In contrast to Veda, Vedic texts are those that are no longer still heard in their original form and are based on only an imperfect memory of the original. There's always a human hand in their composition, and the texts are, therefore, in principle, fallible. Where they are found to be incompatible with Veda, their authority is always trumped by Veda itself. In addition, if any such texts are discovered to be based on personal experiences, the testimony of others, or to be intentionally misleading, they cannot be authoritative and cannot be Vedic. Actual Vedic texts, such as the Sanskrit epics and the Dharma text of Manu, are authoritative because they are based on Veda. Their authoritative status is evident since throughout the world, these texts are accepted by learned men belonging to the three classes, and their simplest way to account for this incontrovertible and observable fact is to assume, Kumarla thinks, that these texts are based on sections of Veda that are no longer available, or on those that are available that can no longer be found, either because those who preserve them live in very remote places that we can't get to double-check, right? Or because those portions of the Veda that support a particular Vedic statement are scattered throughout the Veda and cannot be easily collected or located. See how we're expanding the category of scripture? It was first literally just the Veda itself, which was divided into different kinds of sentences, each having its own kind of authority. We said that injunctions were the most important. Then it slowly expands to include this narrative literature that also contains injunctions. These narratives were composed by people, but the reason why they're considered authoritative is because everything you find in them, more or less, is consistent with Veda, so Kumarla thinks it's safe to assume that if you find something in there that isn't in Veda itself, you can consider it to be just as good as Veda, because it doesn't contradict Veda, and because everything else is consistent with it, this must be based on some portion of the Veda that is lost, either because we can't get to the people who preserve it, or because it is scattered and is hard to locate. The category of scripture expands even more. In addition to the authoritative textual sources for Dharma, Kumarla argues that many of the practices of good learned people are also authoritative. Those practices that are simply for the purpose of maintaining oneself, pleasure, or material gain, however, are generally not taken to be so. This is because such practices are common to everyone, and are usually based on discernible motives and observable results. For Kumarila, only those practices that are unique to good learned people are authoritative with respect to dharma. What these practices are authoritative about is the connection between the observable behavior of good learned people and certain generally desirable results, such as heaven in his case. According to Kumarila, good learned people are those among the inhabitants of the world whose conduct is again observed to be in strict accordance with Veda. When such people are observed to do things that are not prohibited by Veda, but for which there is no textual support in Veda, it may be presumed that they are based on Vedic texts that are lost. Otherwise, why would good people do them? In addition, the Dharma text of Manu clearly states, the practices of good learned men are authoritative with respect to dharma. And so, since the Dharma text of Manu is authoritative, the practice of good learned people must be too. The practices of good learned people are therefore authoritative in that they are, for the most part, based on Veda itself or Vedic texts. For Kumarila, the category of scripture includes an obvious and perhaps surprisingly broad range of texts and practices. These texts and practices can be legitimately classified as scripture because they are the only authoritative resources for our knowledge of dharma. Thus, not only Veda itself, but also texts that are Vedic, like the epics and the Dharma text of Manu, and practices that are determined to be Vedic, like the example set by good learned people, are resources that we may draw upon for learning about what we should and should not do if we want to get certain things that we believe will contribute to our satisfaction in this life and beyond. While Veda itself is independently authoritative, the epics and the Dharma text of Manu and the practices of good learned people are only authoritative by association with Veda. What counts as scripture for Kumarila, then, is any text or practice that is not contradicted by Veda and can, in principle, be shown to be directly or indirectly based on either a known or unknown text of Veda. The variety of ways in which this can be shown is what allows for scripture to be such a broad and seemingly open category. For Kumarila, however, the category of scripture is also narrow, in the sense that, according to him, Veda is the only legitimate basis for the authority of the range of texts and practices that actually do contribute to our knowledge of dharma. Thus, Buddhist and Jain texts, and also those of the Hindu Pancharatrins and Pashupatas, are, according to Kumarila, not scriptural, and therefore are illegitimate resources for our knowledge of dharma. Even supposedly orthodox text traditions, like yoga or Sankhya, and the philosophical and theological frameworks that are based on them are deemed to be non-Vedic by him. For Kumarila, determining what counts as scripture enables one to identify the only legitimate sources for learning about dharma. Understanding the different ways in which these resources are authoritative enables us to learn how they are related to one another, wherein their authority lies, and for which dimensions of dharma they are authoritative. Much of this, however, is just preliminary to what Kumarila thinks can actually be said on the basis of these resources about theological or dharmological matters, and why he thinks that what he says about theology is sanctioned by Veda. For Kumarila, philosophical theology is the attempt to provide a meaningful and defensible framework within which to think about dharma. Remember what dharma is for Kumarila. Dharma is simply how you get stuff you want. It doesn't tell you what you should want. It doesn't tell you if what you want is good or bad. It simply says, for stuff you want, this is the ritual you perform to get it. A very different notion of dharma for this orthodox Hindu theologian than many of us generally assume is the view that Hindus have toward dharma today. Well, it is different than the view that Hindus have toward dharma today. So given Kumarila's view of the relationship between dharma and Veda, theology amounts to providing a framework within which to properly interpret and understand Veda. For Kumarila, then, philosophical theology is inextricably linked with Vedic hermeneutics. Kumarila's position on the status of Veda is such that it requires him to be able to account for each and every expression found in Veda and to interpret and understand Veda from within a framework that is entirely consistent with it and the other sources that he says are authoritative in matters of dharma. Kumarila is also committed to working within the text tradition defined by Jaimini's Mimamsa Sutras and with its philosophical and theological principles. His understanding of scripture and his commitment to the text tradition based on Jaimini thus provide the boundaries within which Kumarla practices philosophical theology. In what follows, I want to discuss three specific examples of how Kumarla relates scripture and theology, with the hope of beginning to discover what he thinks it means to interpret scripture properly and to properly learn from and understand it. How do you decide if what you claim on the basis of scripture is right or not? That's the project now for Kumarla, to look at how he figures it out, how he figures out whether his interpretation is right or not. Right? We've talked about what scripture is, so how do you know if your interpretation is correct? That's the question. So three examples. The first example are these divinities, or so-called devatas. And the question is, given that the talk is about religion without God, what role the names of these divinities, which seems to be gods with at least a small g, play for Kumarla? It is commonplace that when rituals are described in Veda, various gods are invoked and named. Veda states, for example, it is to Vishnu that one must offer the Upamshu ritual. And being pleased, Indra satisfies him with children and cattle. What is not explained, however, is to what the names Vishnu and Indra refer. Are they real embodied beings who actually participate in the ritual? Is their presence necessary for the efficacy of the ritual? Are they the recipients of sacrificial offerings? A common sense reading of the text in question suggests that the various deities referred to are, in fact, real participants in the ritual, and that they may even be the primary objects of ritual activity. After all, the sentences I gave you were, it is to Vishnu that one must offer the Upamshu ritual, or being pleased, Indra satisfies him with children and cattle. So a common sense reading of these texts suggests that the various deities referred to are in fact real participants in the sacrifice, and that they may in fact be the primary objects of ritual activity. That should be clear, right? Such a reading, you'll be happy to know, is also confirmed by over a century of scholarship on Veda and Vedic religion. According to Kumarla, however, this is not at all a proper interpretation of these statements. Kumarla argues that an injunctive statement, such as, it is to Vishnu that one must offer the Upamshu ritual, the name Vishnu is subordinate to the action expressed by the injunction. It serves a syntactic role by indicating a grammatical rather than an actual recipient of the sacrifice. On this line of reasoning, the names Vishnu and Indra are necessary, but for practical reasons. For one who is performing the ritual, Vishnu is the one in whose name the offering is being made. Vishnu is not literally the one to whom the offering is being made. Thus, the statement, it is to Vishnu that one must offer the Upamshu ritual, does not mean that Vishnu is literally a recipient of the offerings, like someone who receives a gift might be. Kumarla also argues, however, that names such as Vishnu and Indra are not just the sounds, Vishnu or Indra, but in fact are proper names that do refer to something. Although he is clear that this something is not an embodied being, he does not discuss in any detail what such names refer to. Given his other philosophical views, however, we can infer that they refer to the concepts, the idea of Vishnu and Indra, which, he says, since time immemorial, come to mind when Vedic statements in which these names appear are recited during the performance of a ritual. According to common sense interpretations of these statements and those based on historical and text-critical methods, in other words, the stuff we learn in school, Kumarla's explanations will seem fanciful and fantastic. What I'm interested in thinking about, however, is according to what kind of hermeneutics does Kumarla's interpretation make sense? Let's consider two more examples before attempting to answer this question. It is to Vishnu that we perform the Upamshu ritual. It seems clear to everyone that Vishnu must be some kind of deity, and he is the recipient of this ritual, or at least it's in his name that we offer it. Kumarla says this is just not the case at all, and I gave you one example of how that is. What we want to ask is he crazy? Is this just completely a crazy way of thinking about interpretation? How could he possibly think this is correct? And that's in fact what many commentators have done. They've dismissed these traditional Hindu commentators by saying, that isn't at all what those texts must mean. So what I want us to ask now, looking at the other two examples, is can we come up with a hermeneutics according to which Kumarla's interpretation or way of interpreting makes good sense? Not just sense, but let's say good sense. Two more examples. So in Veda, there are passages in which the goal of liberation is mentioned and that knowledge of Brahman and or the self is enjoined, seemingly for the purposes of liberation. Famous examples include statements such as, "It is he that Brahmins seek to know by means of Vedic recitation, sacrifice, gift-giving, austerity, and fasting. It is he on knowing whom a man becomes a sage." A man who knows Brahman knows the highest that there is. I myself am Brahman. Only when the man knows him does he pass beyond death. There is no other path for getting there. It is the self that is to be known. One should investigate the self. One should seek and know it. And it is through knowledge that one's become free from death. Those statements clearly seem to talk about liberation. They seem to talk about the self. And they seem to say that knowledge of the self is how you get liberation. Straightforward interpretation. As with the statements of Veda cited earlier, text-critical scholarship supports a rather straightforward reading of these statements, which leads one to suppose that liberation is important and that it is only achieved through knowledge of Brahman and or the self that one can become a sage or achieve freedom from death. According to Kumarla, however, things like heaven and not liberation are enjoined, and it is action, not knowledge, that is of primary importance in bringing about such results. How then does Kumarla interpret and explain these passages? Kumarla admits that there are Vedic injunctions to know thyself and argues that they serve two purposes, neither of which is accurately captured by the straightforward reading. He says, for example, that knowing something about the self, for example, that it survives the death of the body, is related to ritual activity, since it helps to explain why one would undertake very lengthy Vedic sacrifices whose results, for example, heaven, could only be enjoyed in a future life. Knowing that the self survives the body seems to be necessary for Kumarla if one is actually going to undertake such complicated, lengthy, and expensive rituals. So we have a statement. The self survives the death of the body. It doesn't have the straightforward reading. That simply, it's a fact that the self survives the death of the body, but it's important for ritual activity, because otherwise, why would anyone today perform a ritual where you're only going to get the results in 1,000 years? If you didn't think the self supported the body, I mean, the self survived beyond the body, why would you do it? You wouldn't, he thinks. So this statement is a kind of motivation. It's not to be taken literally. So against the straightforward reading of the above passages, Kumarla argues that such injunctions do not support the interpretation that knowledge of the self brings about liberation. He explains that statements in which liberation is mentioned are as a desirable result are not really injunctive. Rather, they are recommending narratives that help motivate a person to undertake lengthy Vedic rituals that result not in liberation, but in heaven. Remember we talked about earlier how the Vedas divide into different kinds of sentences and that injunctions are the most important? Those are the commands that get you to do things or that tell you to do things. And there are other kinds of statements that support it. So he says the statements which seem to be telling you to do X to get liberation aren't at all about liberation. They're actually cheerleaders for why you should want heaven instead. So he takes a statement that some people think of as an injunction and reclassifies it as a recommending narrative. In addition, if liberation is supposed to be an eternal state beyond pleasure and pain, Kumarla concludes that it cannot be brought about by any kind of practice. This conclusion is based on the philosophical principle that anything that can be caused can only endure for a limited period of time. Kumarla argues, therefore, that if liberation is something that can be brought about, it must be a type of cessation that is brought about by the elimination of its cause. Thus, whatever liberation is, it cannot be the kind of thing that is brought about by knowledge of the self. Even though seeking liberation is not enjoined, Kumarla recognizes that there may be people who still want to be liberated. For such people, he provides an explanation of what liberation could be and how one could obtain it. He points out that liberation cannot consist in the enjoyment of pleasure, since then it would be equivalent to heaven. On the basis of this, he argues that liberation must simply be the absence of rebirth, and that if one were interested in liberation, it could not be through knowledge, but through ritual action that it could be attained. More specifically, Kumarla says that this sort of liberation can be attained only by exhausting all of one's previous karma and avoiding any future karma. He explains that one is able to exhaust one's previous karma by experiencing its positive and negative effects, and that one can avoid further karma by performing certain obligatory ritual acts, and by not doing anything that has been characterized as either optional or prohibited. He qualifies this later point this latter point by explaining the performance of obligatory ritual actions is neutral, only if they are undertaken without any desire for their results. It is in this sense of detachment, he says, that is the result of knowing the self. It is worth noting that according to Kumarila, attaining liberation by exhausting one's accumulated karma could take millions of years. So again, for those who want liberation, he basically says, it's not what you think it is, and it'll take you a million years. And in fact, even if you want liberation, you still must perform certain kinds of ritual activities that I've been talking about all along, that are actually going to get you to heaven if you do them right. Okay. Again, the question I want us to keep in mind is, according to what kind of hermeneutics would Kumarla's interpretation make sense? Third example. Vedic sacrifices are extremely complex ritual processes that can last for days. Even the simpler rituals are composed of a seemingly innumerable number of ritual acts, each of which is enjoined by Veda and which together bring about a desired result, even in the distant future. What is not explained in great detail in Veda itself is how this is supposed to work. As a part of his overall philosophical and theological project to explain and defend the significance and efficacy of Vedic rituals, Kumarla provides an explanation. According to Kumarla, each ritual act leaves or creates in the self of the performer a disposition to produce a specified effect. These dispositions accumulate until, at the completion of the ritual, they combine with each other in order to leave in the soul a final composite disposition which endures, and in due time, either in this life or the next, produces its specified result. Kumarla helpfully uses the examples of farming, and maybe for all of us, studying, to explain how the accumulated effect of many, many actions can lead to a desired future result. He refers to this change in the self or soul of a person who correctly performs a Vedic ritual as being due to what he calls apurva. It may be helpful to think of apurva as what connects an act to its result. Since neither the term nor Kumarla's concept of apurva can be found in a single authoritative text, Kumarla must explain how and why it can have a central role in his theology. Is that all right? He's supposed to explain how rituals work. He says Veda is the only authoritative source. His theory requires that there be this thing called apurva that accrues in you on each ritual act and that eventually matures and produces an effect. The problem is this concept of apurva isn't in the Veda. So what does he do? In order to do so, Kumarla appeals to an epistemological and hermeneutical principle known as indispensable implication, through which one can learn about certain things in virtue of those things being necessarily implied, either by some observed fact or by known Vedic words or statements. Since, according to Kumarla, apurva is implied by Veda, his use and interpretation of it is thus sanctioned by scripture and is, in fact, scriptural. You see what he does? He says, look, this has to be how this works. And because of that, we can conclude that it really must be sanctioned by Veda, even though it isn't in Veda itself. Just like we saw with the narrative text, there's an injunction there in a body of work, in a text that is otherwise consistent with Veda. And this particular injunction, even it isn't contradicted by Veda, so therefore it must be in some way sanctioned by Veda. Not only does Kumarla's hermeneutics allow him to interpret Veda in seemingly fanciful and fantastic ways, but as his treatment of Apurva shows, it also allows him to attribute to Veda concepts that are not at all present in it. In concluding this paper, I want to finally address the question of according to what kind of hermeneutics, if any, this makes sense. So remember, imagine you're writing a paper for a course or writing a paper for publication in which you're interpreting a particular text. And you try any of Kumarla's tactics. What are you likely to get on that paper? You're either likely to get an F or you're likely to get it rejected from a journal, right? Basically. But we want to figure out, Kumarla is a very smart person. So according to what kind of hermeneutic principle, what kind of hermeneutic picture, could this be a very good idea? According to what hermeneutics would this be a preferred way, perhaps, of interpreting a text? The range of texts and practices that Kumarla includes in the category of scripture provides him with a variety of resources with which to develop his philosophical theology, and to which it must also be entirely responsible. Without scripture, there could not be a theology, that is, any legitimate reflection on dharma. and thus Scripture is the only possible basis for theology and the ultimate source of its authority and legitimacy. In order to learn from Scripture and practice theology, however, it is necessary to properly interpret and understand it. Although some of the hermeneutical principles that Kumarla relies on to understand Scripture may be present in Scripture itself, Kumarla clearly draws upon the resources of his text tradition and his own philosophical and theological creativity. In his work, he thus balances and integrates his commitment to Scripture, the philosophical and theological principles of his text tradition, and his own sense of what is right. One of the most striking features of Kumarla's approach to Veda is his decision to not attend to historical contexts or to intra- or intertextual contexts in a manner familiar to us from more contemporary forms of text criticism. The reason for the first decision is relatively clear, since for Kumarla at least, Veda itself is not historical. It is authorless and eternal. And although other texts and practices that have scriptural content are historical, their scriptural content is not. For Kumarla, then, there is no historical world in which Veda itself was produced, and so attention to its history is impossible. And while Kumarla would agree that some Vedic texts, such as the epics, right, that I told you were written by people, and the Dharma text of Manu, and Vedic practices, such as the conduct of good learned people, are historical, in that they are the products of specific times and places, he argues that their scriptural content is not. Thus, when compared to Veda itself, historical context is irrelevant, even though it may be relevant for understanding other aspects of Vedic texts and practices. Kumarla's treatment of intra- and intertextual context is also striking. It is important, for example, that Kumarla never comments on an entire text, for example, the hymns of a particular Veda or a single Upanishad, and does not privilege textual proximity in anything like the way that we generally do. Intratextual contexts defined by single texts are, therefore, less significant for him than the intertextual context of Scripture as a whole. Even Kumarla's reliance on this intertextual context, however, is more about individual sentences than about sentences in the context of paragraphs, chapters, or whole texts. For Kumarla, the context that is most relevant for interpreting and understanding a specific Vedic sentence is defined by the textual world that is constructed around the injunction with which the sentence in question can be most closely associated. Thus, an injunction serves as the focal point for the construction of a textual world that is made up of all those sentences in Scripture that can be determined to be relevant to the sacrifice referred to in that particular injunction. Remember, Veda is about getting stuff you want. You get there by performing a ritual. Veda's got all kinds of sentences. The one that's most important is the one that tells you to do a particular kind of ritual. That's the central sentence. To understand that, you've got to collect all the other things from the other parts of Veda that have to do with that sentence, right? Such as the names that you need to call to mind. You need to get the cheerleaders to motivate you to do that ritual. That is how you decide what other parts of the text are relevant and which ones aren't. That something is next to this sentence, or that something is the next chapter, or closer, is totally irrelevant. The order is irrelevant, as is history. History is also irrelevant. So two things that we rely on in our hermeneutics generally, historical context, textual proximity, he has no reason to pay attention to. So the injunction serves as the focal point. So it is through a set of principles for determining subordination, and especially subordination to an injunction, that the relevant textual world is defined. It is important to remember that this textual world can be constructed even around a focal point that is no longer available. Remember, there can be injunctions that are lost. So you can construct a whole textual world for interpreting an injunction that is lost. Very few of the principles that are used to construct this world, however, are internal to the world itself, and most are brought to it and defended on more philosophical grounds. For Kumarla, then, if neither historical nor intra- or intertextual contexts are of primary importance for properly interpreting and understanding Scripture, what kind of context is? I want to suggest that the most important context for Kumarla is an intellectual one, defined by his commitments to what Scripture is and why it is authoritative, his commitments to his text tradition and its philosophical and theological principles, and his commitment to what he thinks is right. These three sets of commitments are all defended by independent philosophical arguments. They also support and inform one another, and it would be a mistake to see any one of them as primary or foundational. Each is in a kind of reflective equilibrium with the others. When taken together, these commitments constitute the intellectual framework that is his philosophical theology. Even though an account of Scripture and its authoritative status is itself a part of this framework, in my view, it is the entire framework that is a primary context within which scriptural statements are supposed to be properly interpreted and understood. In an important sense, Kumarla reverses the familiar order of moving from Scripture to theology by bringing his theology to Scripture. I want to refer to this approach to Scripture as a hermeneutics of principled consumerism. According to this hermeneutic model, what it means to properly interpret and understand Scripture is just to make good sense of it, to consume it, if you will, in accordance with one's own interests, as a way of showing one's commitment to it, as a way of being faithful to it, and in recognition of its uniquely authoritative status. That a scriptural statement has been properly interpreted and correctly understood can only be determined, according to this model, within the context of the entire framework that is one's philosophical theology. More specifically, the success of one's interpretation is directly related to the success of the framework. As I read Kumarla, then, it is because his framework can explain how and why Vedic rituals and practice are effective, and because it cannot be defeated by any known philosophical argument, that it properly interprets Scripture and exemplifies a correct understanding of it. For Kumarla, then, what Vedic statements are really about is what his philosophical theology says they are. The metaphor of theology as a renovation project may be helpful for thinking about the ways in which this consumerist hermeneutics is also principled. For Kumarla, the challenge to take an existing framework, defined by his philosophical theology of his text tradition, and to renovate it according to a strict set of rules. Some of these rules have to do with the resources that one may use in the renovation, while others have to do with the way in which they may be used. According to Kumarla, for example, one may only use material from a certain source, that is Veda and what is sanctioned by Veda, and one must use these materials in accordance with the way they're classified, that is, you can't use a recommending narrative as if it were an injunction. Doing otherwise would be misusing the materials. So think of Veda in a way like Home Depot, right? Home Depot is divided into sections. There's a plumbing section, there's an appliance section, there's a lumber section. If you use something in the plumbing section, say a toilet, for something in the living room section, say an armchair, Kumarla would say that's misusing that piece. Right? It's misusing it. So that's there. It's not just you can use Home Depot in any way you like. There are certain principles that he has that decide what counts as using it appropriately and what counts as not using it appropriately. How do you decide if it's appropriate or not? He says you have to look at my house. You look at the house I build with these rules, and I will show you it's a far better house than the house you would build with your rules. Who wants a toilet for an armchair? Right? So it's house versus house. And if my house is better, that means I've interpreted Home Depot better. I've made better use of Home Depot. You just got to think of Home Depot as Veda and the house as your theology. All right? In addition, for Kumarla, there can be no unused pieces in the structure that is being renovated or in the materials that one is using for the renovation. Each and every piece must be accounted for. What counts as success is creating, in accordance with these rules, the best structure that one can from the pieces that one has. On this model, this is just what it means to make good and proper use of both the material that one is committed to using, Veda and what is sanctioned by it, and the original structure that one is committed to renovating, the philosophical theology of one's text tradition. What is principled about Kumarla's consumerism is there are very strict rules on what you can use for your renovation and in how you can use those materials. What is consumerist about his work is that Kumarla already has a plan for what his finished structure will look like. On this model, questions about the legitimate use, purpose, or value of a piece of building material can only be determined in the light of the structure as a whole and the rules of renovation. Similarly, for Kumarla, it is not possible to understand the meaning of Scripture without understanding its role in the theological framework that actually gives it meaning. To be genuinely open to what Sanskrit philosophers and theologians have to say about Scripture, hermeneutics, and the relationship between texts and contexts, we must be open to radically revising not only our understanding of the basic concepts which we think about these issues, but also our standards of evaluation. Although Kumarla's interpretation of Veda may still seem fanciful and fantastic, I hope that I've been able to explain, at least in a preliminary fashion, why Kumarla and nearly everyone else in classical India did not think that a consumerist approach to scripture was problematic, and why they did think that intellectual context provided the most important context for understanding Veda. When we take Kumarla's work seriously, we're able to see how deep commitments to scripture and to text tradition in fact made possible much of the creativity and innovation that is so characteristic of Sanskrit philosophical theology. I thought I'd end with a verse, with like just a Sanskrit verse so you can hear some. And this one seems to fit some of the issues we've talked about, or how you could be both principled, right, sort of stick to tradition in some way, and consumerist, in a sense, also innovate. And it goes like this. It goes, Api sputati vindyadrau vati va pralayanile guru shastranugo margaha parityajyo nadhimatam. It says, even if the Vindhya mountains begin to crumble and the winds that bring about the destruction of the world begin to blow, the path of one's teacher and text tradition is never abandoned by those with wisdom. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Parimal Patel, professor of religion and Indian philosophy and chair of the Department of South Asian Studies at Harvard University. Professor Patel's lecture was titled Religion Without God, An Indian Perspective, and was presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion. Tonight's moderator was Institute for Philosophy and Religion Chair David Eckel. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Paul Kahlo. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.